You're listening to DTFHN for May 8th, 2026. I'm your structurally compromised host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who build systems argue about why systems fail. Today, everything's a little exposed, a little raw, and nobody's wearing a hard hat. Strap in. The foundation's cracking. Canvas going down during finals week is the kind of story that sounds like satire but lands like a gut punch. 275 million records, 9,000 schools, students mid-exam, professors scrambling, and the platform they all depend on. Owned by a company called Instructure. Just goes dark. Let's pull this thread, because the technical failure here is worth understanding. Shiny hunters didn't just exfiltrate data. They got deep enough to modify what students and teachers saw when they logged in. They replaced Canvas pages with their own ransom message. That's not a smash and grab. That's persistent access to production systems with write privileges to user-facing content. The attack vector? Free for teacher accounts Instructure has confirmed the breach came through that surface. Which means a feature designed to make the platform accessible. Give teachers free access, lower the barrier. Became the door that compromised every paying institution on the platform. And here's what makes this architecturally damning. Canvas is a centralized, proprietary, multi-tenant platform. When one tenant's entry point gets compromised, the blast radius is every tenant. 9,000 schools didn't each make a security mistake. They made one collective mistake. They all trusted the same vendor with the same infrastructure running the same code. One commenter pointed out that MIT, of all places, is affected. MIT, home to some of the best computer science faculty on Earth. Outsourced their learning management to a SaaS platform and got caught in someone else's breach. The irony is sharp, but the real lesson is structural. When you hand your infrastructure to a vendor, you're not just buying convenience. You're buying their attack surface, their patch schedule, their decision about whether to engage with the threat actor or ignore them. Which is apparently what Instructure did the first time shiny hunters came knocking. The human cost is real. And it matters. Students in the middle of finals. Professors who don't have offline copies of their own materials. One Stanford student described being mid-quarter with no access to coursework. These aren't abstraction. These are people whose academic lives got held hostage because of architectural decisions they had no say in. The alternative exists. Open-source learning management systems like Moodle and OpenEggs let institutions run their own infrastructure, control their own security posture, and limit blast radius to their own walls. The trade-off is operational burden. Sure, but the trade-off for centralized SaaS is what we're watching right now. 275 million people paying for someone else's shortcut. The tools exist. The question is whether institutions will keep renting someone else's house or finally build their own. Building your own house takes people. Cloudflare, meanwhile, is showing what happens when a company decides it has too many. When does efficiency become extraction? It's a question worth sitting with. Because Cloudflare just gave us a case study that cuts right to the bone. Cloudflare is laying off more than 1,100 people. Roughly 20% of the company. And the justification is fascinating. Not revenue trouble. Not poor performance. CEO Matthew Prince says AI usage inside the company has increased 600% in 3 months. And the company needs to, quote, reimagine every internal process, team, and role for the agentic AI era. Let me draw a line back to 1995, when AT&T split into three companies and laid off 40,000 workers, Robert Allen. their CEO at the time, framed it as necessary modernization. The stock bumped, executives got bonuses, and a generation of telephone engineers discovered that restructuring is a word that only ever flows downhill. The technology changed, sure, but the pattern of who bears the cost, that's been remarkably stable for 30 years. Now, credit where it's earned. Cloudflare's severance is genuinely strong. Full base pay through end of year. Equity vesting extended, even waiving one-year clips for newer employees. That matters. That's real money that will keep real families stable during a transition. And Print sending every notification personally rather than farming it to middle manager. That's a choice that reflects some actual accountability. But here's what I keep turning over. One of the affected engineers posted on Hacker News, an engineering manager whose products run at 95% profit margins, was actively trying to hire because the team was buried in work, still cut. That's not optimization. That's a thesis about labor itself. It's the bet that AI agents can replace the people building 95% margin products, and that the margins will get even wider when you don't have to pay human. And the timing is sharp. Last September, Cloudflare hired 1,100 interns under a program called Help Build the Future. 1,100 in, 1,100 out. The symmetry is almost poetic if you don't think about the people inside those numbers. The deeper question isn't whether AI makes companies more productive. It obviously does. The question is architectural, when productivity gains flow exclusively to shareholders while workers absorb all the displacement risk. You've built a closed system. The value goes up and stays up. The people who generated it get a severance package and a LinkedIn update, the alternative. And it exists. Is building AI tooling in the open, where displaced workers can harness the same capabilities independently. Where the efficiency isn't captured, it's distributed. Open source AI isn't charity. It's the infrastructure that turns a layoff from an ending into a pivot. The tools exist. The question is, who gets to use them? Moving on. In 1984, Ken Thompson stood at the ACM Turing Award podium and calmly explained how he backdoored the Unix C compiler, so it would insert a Trojan into the login program, and then insert the Trojan inserting code into any clean copy of the compiler itself. The attack was invisible to source code review. The binary was the lie. Thompson's actual point was philosophical. You can't trust code you didn't write yourself. 42 years later, we're still learning that lesson. Except now the compiler is NPM, and the binaries are 17 layers of transitive dependencies deep. Iaso's post is short, almost terse. New Linux kernel vulns dropped in the wake of copy.fail. Multiple privilege escalation vectors. And their advice is simple. Maybe don't install anything new for a week. Think of it like a city after an earthquake. The shaking has stopped, but the building inspectors haven't cleared the structures yet. You don't walk into a high-rise just because the lobby looks fine. The foundation might be cracked in ways you can't see from the street. Right now, the open-source supply chain is that city. The tremors hit, the damage reports are still coming in, and every fresh package install is walking into an uninspected building. The comments are split in a revealing way. One camp says this is paranoid. These are just local privilege escalations. Calm down. The other camp points out that NPM's dependency graph is essentially a trust graph, where you're trusting thousands of strangers simultaneously. And any one of them pushing a compromise update right now would hit systems already scrambling to patch. The second camp is correct. Here's what's worth sitting with, though. The free BSD commenter and the version pinning commenter are both circling the same architectural insight. The problem isn't open source. The problem is open source without verification infrastructure, reproducible builds, delayed package ingestion, dependency auditing. These are solved problems that most of the ecosystem just doesn't bother implementing. We treat package registries like vending machines, when they should be treated like pharmacies. Everything dispensed, everything checked, everything traceable. The beautiful irony is that open source is what makes this solvable. You can audit the code, you can reproduce the build, you can verify the supply chain end to end. Closed source vendors ask you to trust their signature and pray. Open source gives you the actual receipt. We just need to start reading them. But the longer play is building the verification layer that makes this kind of moratorium unnecessary. The tools exist. The packaging infrastructure is open. Someone just has to wire it together and make it the default. We talked earlier about hardware pushing boundaries. Well, Nintendo's pushing something else entirely. The Switch 2 is getting a price hike. I've spent enough time building pricing systems to know that the math always tells a story the press release won't. Nintendo just raised the Switch 2 from $449 to $499 in the US, and the Japanese language model from 49,980 yen to 59,980 yen. That's an 11% bump stateside and a 20% bump domestically. Two very different numbers. One explanation, the yen. Pull this apart to first principles. Nintendo is a Japanese company. They pay engineers in yen. They run factories in yen-denominated contracts. They report earnings in yen. The yen has lost roughly 30% of its value against the dollar since 2022, which means every unit sold in America at the old price was effectively a deeper discount than Nintendo intended. The Japanese price hike isn't greed. It's purchasing power parity catching up with currency reality. The US bump is smaller because the dollar side was already doing Nintendo favors. What's genuinely funny, in that deadpan stare at the spreadsheet way, is watching the same company that still manufactures Hanafuda cards in Kyoto try to navigate global macroeconomics in real time. They're raising prices on the Daitoryo, a traditional card set they've been making since 1889. The new price isn't even set yet. It just says, open price. Nintendo has been in the entertainment business longer than most nations have had stable currencies. And even they can't figure out what cardboard should cost right now. The deeper pattern here is that hardware has always been the constraint. Consoles are closed systems sold at thin margins or losses. And the real revenue is software and services. Notice they're also bumping Nintendo Switch Online. The 12-month individual plan in Japan goes from 2,400 to 3,000 yen. That's the subscription layer, the recurring revenue, the part investors actually care about. The hardware price increase gives them cover to raise everything else. One commenter nailed it. They're still waiting for a mainline Mario game before buying. That's the actual market signal. $50 more isn't the barrier. The barrier is always the software. Nintendo knows this better than anyone. They've been selling the same plumber for 40 years. The price tag on the box is just the door. The game is what pulls you through it. This one's for the language nerds, and I mean that with pure affection. ClojureScript had channels and Go routines before JavaScript even knew what a promise was. Core.async shipped in 2013. JavaScript's async await didn't land until 2017, 4 years. The language that runs in the browser had to wait 4 years to catch up to a language that compiles to the browser. And now, in 2026, ClojureScript is adding async await support. Not because it needs it, but because the ecosystem around it does. This is worth understanding. ClojureScript already solved asynchronous programming. Communicating sequential processes, borrowed from Go, borrowed from Hoare's 1978 paper. It was elegant. It was principled. And it required pulling in core.async as a dependency every single time you wanted to call a browser API that returned a promise. Every time you wanted to use a popular JavaScript library. Every time you wanted to do the most basic thing that modern web development demands. Follow that to its logical end. You have a language with a superior concurrency model, but the entire JavaScript world speaks a different dialect. Every fetch call, every IndexedDB operation, every web audio app I interaction. All promise-based. You can wrap them in channels. People did for years. But wrapping is friction, and friction is the enemy of adoption. The release notes are almost understated. Hint a function as async, use await inside it, and the compiler emits a JavaScript async function. That's it. The surface area is tiny. The impact is not. This is ClojureScript dropping the toll booth on the bridge between its world and JavaScript's byte. A language that already had the better abstraction is now saying, we'll also speak yours, natively, without ceremony. One commenter put it well. It's been a good time to get into ClojureScript for a while now. That's true. And it's also the problem. ClojureScript has been the best-kept secret in front-end development for over a decade. Immutable data structures by default. A real macro system. Hot reloading that actually works. But every unnecessary dependency, every extra build step, every just add core.async was another reason for someone to stick with TypeScript. This release removes one more excuse. The tools exist. The language is open. The compiler is open. The community has been building in the open since day one. What ClojureScript needs now isn't better technology. It's fewer barriers between that technology and the people who'd benefit from it. But what happens when openness meets the operating system itself? Story 6. Dirty Frag. Mofriska's build. Dirty Frag pose a universal Linux privilege escalation that just changed the game. Three kernel modules, ESP4, ESP6, RxRPC. Most Linux users have never loaded them deliberately. Most Linux users are running them right now. That gap between what's loaded and what's needed is where Dirty Frag lives. Unwoo Kim published a full local privilege escalation chain this week that works on every major Linux distribution. Root on any box, unprivileged user to full control. Chains two bugs in networking code that ships enabled by default. The exploit overwrites USR by SUL with a 192-byte ELF that drops you into a root shell. 192 bytes. The entire weaponized binary fits in less space than this paragraph. The disclosure story is almost more interesting than the vulnerability itself. Kim found the bugs, reported them through proper channels, coordinated with Linux distro's maintainers. Then someone broke the embargo. No patches existed. No CVEs had been assigned. The maintainers asked Kim to go fully public so defenders could at least apply the mitigation, which is a three-line mod probe config that blocks the vulnerable modules from loading. Now here's where it's worth playing devil's advocate. One commenter argued, the kernel maintainers are irresponsible for shipping optional functionality loaded by default, and the instinct is to agree. But consider the alternative universe, where these modules aren't auto-loaded. Every VPN implementation that depends on ESP encapsulation breaks silently. Every enterprise deployment that touches IPsec needs manual kernel configuration. The attack surface exists because the functionality is genuinely useful to a subset of users and genuinely invisible to everyone else. The real failure isn't that the modules ship. It's that a closely related vulnerability called copy fail was patched months ago, but the underlying pattern in offenses wasn't addressed. One commenter on the thread pointed this out with justified frustration. The fix was narrow. The bug class was wide. Dirty frag is what happens next. Patches have already landed for kernel 7.0, 6.u, 6.1day, 6.zing. The turnaround once the embargo broke was fast. But the fact that the entire coordinated disclosure process failed before a patch existed is the detail worth sitting with. The Linux security model depends on that process working. When it doesn't, the mitigation is a shell one-liner posted to a mailing list, and the exploit is on GitHub. The kernel is open, the exploit is open, the fix is open, the mailing list is open. The process broke, and the openness is what made recovery possible in hours instead of weeks. Every link in this chain is visible, auditable, forkable. That's the difference between a security incident and a security crisis. Moving on. One commenter put it perfectly. A giant party can clean up after itself, but 4th of July in Tahoe is a toxic mess. That contrast is the whole story. Every year, 70,000 people build a city on a dry lake bed in Nevada. 8 days later, they tear it down. And then, 150 people line up shoulder to shoulder and walk 3,900 acres, scanning the dust for screws, sequins, cigarette butts. They call it moot. Matter out of place. The sweep takes weeks. Everything gets logged. Geolocated, categorized. What comes out the other end is a color-coded map of exactly what 70,000 humans left behind. Down to the lag bolt. This is measurement as governance. The Bureau of Land Management requires no more than 1 square foot of debris per acre across 120 test points. Fail that inspection, and Black Rock City doesn't come back. The constraint is existential, and the community's response is engineering. Not rules, not fines, a map. Pull this thread and you find something genuinely elegant. Camps that land in red zones get a detailed breakdown of what was found on their footprint. Persistent offenders get flagged when future spots are assigned. There's a Reddit shame thread. The feedback loop is tight, public, and it works. Debris per capita peaked in 2010 and has been declining since, even as the city grew dramatically in size and complexity. 20 years of data confirm it. What makes this worth studying is the architecture. The moot map is an open ledger. Everyone can see the results. Everyone's accountable to the same standard. The data is shared. The methodology is transparent, and the incentive structure rewards improvement rather than compliance theater. One commenter who's actually walked the line noted the scale is even larger than the article suggests. Nearly 4,000 acres in 2025. The people doing the work know the system because the system is legible to them. Leave no trace is a principle. Principles are cheap. The moot map turns a principle into a protocol. Observable, repeatable, improvable. That's the difference between aspiration and accountability. And the player passes inspection year after year because the community can see its own impact and choose to do better. That's how you govern a temporary city of 70,000 people. You measure everything, you publish it, and you let transparency do the work that enforcement never could. We talked earlier about making knowledge accessible. Here's a story about making documents actually usable. Let's pull this thread. Let me make the strongest case for the status quo first. PDF is a 30-year-old format designed for print. It was never meant to be generated in a browser. The specification runs to nearly 1,000 pages. Any reasonable engineer would say, generate your PDF server-side, where you have mature libraries, proper font subsetting, and decades of battle-tested tooling. Why would you fight the browser to do something it was never designed for? Now, let me dismantle that. The browser is the most sophisticated layout engine humanity has ever built. CSS can handle flexbox, grid, multi-column layouts, complex typography, right-to-left text, and it does all of this across every writing system on Earth. Server-side PDF libraries, they make you rebuild all of that from scratch. You're essentially writing a layout engine inside a layout engine. The browser already solved positioning. It already solved font rendering. It already solved responsive reflow. The engineering craft that went into modern browser rendering is staggering, and ignoring it to hand roll coordinates in a PDF library is not pragmatism. It's waste. Run this forward. Imagine every document generation workflow could use HTML and CSS. As the layout language and produce pixel-perfect, text-selectable PDFs directly in the client. No server round trips. No spinning up headless Chrome instances. No paying per document to some SaaS rendering API. The user's own machine does the work. The technical challenge is real and worth admiring. Text selectability in PDFs requires an invisible text layer positioned precisely behind the visible rendered glyphs. You need accurate font metrics, correct character to coordinate mapping, and you need to handle every edge case. Ligatures, kerning, bidirectional text, embedded fonts with incomplete metadata. The gap between it looks right and you can select and copy the text is enormous. One commenter nailed it. Software engineers drastically underestimate layout work. Getting pixels right in all circumstances is genuinely hard engineering. What makes this story worth celebrating is that the team at AskDocs is building this in the open. The blog post doesn't just announce a feature. It walks you through the pain, the invisible text layer approach, the font metric extraction, the coordinate math. They're showing their work, which means the next team that tackles this problem starts from a higher floor. This is build a culture at its best. A hard problem, a public write-up, and working code that turns the browser into what it should have been all along. The universal document engine. We talked earlier about tools becoming something new. Well, Pinocchio might be the wildest transformation story yet. What was children's literature actually for in 1881? That's the question nobody asking why is Pinocchio so dark ever bothers with, because the answer reframes everything. Carlo Collodi was a 50-something satirist, a guy who'd founded newspapers that got shut down by dukes, who'd fought in two wars for Italian independence, and who took a magazine commission because the newly unified Italian state was paying writers to produce school readers. Steady money. He wasn't crafting a moral fable. He was cashing a check and settling scores with every saccharine children's book that came before him. The original serial ran 8 episodes and ended with the puppet hanging dead from an oak tree. Full stop, Collodi collected his fee and walked away. The story we know. The fairy, the redemption, the becoming a real boy, arc, only exists because Italian children wrote letters begging him to continue, and the magazine presumably wrote another check. Pull this thread and the craft decisions start making sense. The talking cricket lectures Pinocchio about respecting his father, and Pinocchio kills it with a hammer. Deadpan. Police report narration. That's not darkness for shock value. That's a satirist laughing at every moralizing authority figure who ever wagged a finger at a working-class kid. The donkey skin drum sequence, where Pinocchio is sold to a man who wants to drown him and stretch his hide over a percussion instrument. That's Collodi detonating the genre from the inside. Here's what the Disney version did. It took a text that was fundamentally about the absurdity of trying to moralize poverty and obedience into children, and it flattened it into exactly the kind of sentimental fable Collodi was mocking. The cricket becomes a conscience. The fairy becomes a benevolent godmother. The hanging gets erased entirely. One commenter made the point that children are perfectly capable of understanding cruelty and death, and that overprotectiveness is how you get adults who can't advocate for themselves. Collodi would have agreed. His book trusted kids with the ugliness. The sanitized version trusts them with nothing. The original text is in the public domain. It's freely available in Italian. The tools exist. Read the actual thing. And since we're celebrating what you can build with raw source material, let's talk about someone doing exactly that with nothing but CSS. When does a visual trick cross the line from clever to broken? That's a real question when you're simulating dithering entirely in CSS. Here's the setup. Someone build a pure CSS approach to dithering images. No canvas, no JavaScript, no pre-processing pipeline. You take a photograph, throw some shader-like CSS on it, and out comes something that looks like it rolled off a dot matrix printer in 1987. The technique uses threshold quantization with noise patterns, essentially deciding pixel by pixel whether something is black or white based on a brightness cutoff plus some generated noise. And the comments are ruthless. Is this actually dithering? The image quality is so bad, I don't get it. It looks like some sort of error slash glitch. One person correctly identifies it as threshold quantized Perlin noise rather than proper ordered or error diffusion dithering. Floyd Steinberg, this is not. But pull this thread a little further. The interesting thing isn't whether the output is museum quality. It's that someone built a real-time image processing pipeline using nothing but a style sheet. CSS was designed to make text bold and put borders on boxes. Now it's doing per-pixel brightness calculations. The browser is the runtime, the language is declarative, and the whole thing ships in kilobytes. This is what happens when you give people an open platform and enough time. The web browser is the most democratized creative tool ever built. Every experiment like this, even the ones that look rough around the edges, is someone learning what the medium can do by pushing it past what it was designed for. The polished version comes later. The tinkering comes first. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for May 8th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voice by Quinn3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something rough and real and yours. We'll see you back here tomorrow.